Named after the mechanism that separates the sweet wort from the spent grain, False Bottom Girls helps you filter through the wonderful yet sometimes confusing world of beer.
Hey, I'm Rachel Hudson, head brewer and co-owner of Pilot Brewing and an advanced cicerone.
Hi, I'm Jen Blair, master cicerone, home brewer, and sensory expert. False Bottom Girls is proudly sponsored by Jasper Yeast, yeasts that are out of this world. Learn more about Jasper Yeast at jasperyeast.com. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of False Bottom Girls. And today, we're doing, by special request, and by special request, I mean by my special request, we're doing a deep dive.
I was like, tell me who!
It's me! We're doing a deep dive into acetaldehyde. And I'm so excited about it that I forgot to say, hi, I'm Jen.
I'm Rachel.
And yeah, so... Rachel, I know acetaldehyde is kind of one of your nemeses when it comes to off flavors.
Yes, I have gotten a lot better.
I was going to say, I feel like you've gotten better. And it's really funny, you know, like if you have an iPhone, and I assume that the other Android, right? I can remember the name of the other phones. I assume they do the same thing where like you go into your pictures and it will give you like an album of, you know, like furry friends through the years or something like that. And so I was watching them the other night, and I have one that is of Rachel, where it's just like Rachel over the years or something. And yeah. It's like all these pictures of us. And then there's the picture that I took of Rachel at Pilot Project Brewing in Chicago. The first time we took the master exam, that was November of 2021, I think.
Yeah, it was
It was cold.
It was pre-COVID or post-COVID.
Yes. And we were at Pilot Project and we were just talking about the exam, and Rachel said, you know, like I've got this spike of acetaldehyde, so I'm going to put it in this beer. And so she did, like she put an entire spike of acetaldehyde
made for like a liter
into like 10 ounces. Just like
I am going to find out if I am blind or not.
Yeah.
This is the time.
But there also, since it was fall time, they had like all of these little decorations on the table, and one of them was a little pumpkin. So I have this picture of Rachel with this pumpkin like shoved up to her face because we were like, oh yeah, pumpkin. And she's like, let me just smell this. And so that was like the cover photo of this like Rachel album that my phone made for me, is you with this pumpkin smashed up against your face.
That is so hilarious that you say that, because the exact same thing happened to me like maybe a month ago. And it was that picture that came up. It wasn't just a random other picture. It was like, this is your time spent here during this time. And I was like, yep, I remember that. Someone says smells like raw pumpkin. I don't get it. I don't think it smells like raw pumpkin. I get like a white wine character, but
and we will learn that is actually incorrect.
Yes. So
I've got that in my notes today, but maybe our social media picture will be the one of you with the pumpkin.
Absolutely.
Okay, perfect. So everybody in this audio medium where I'm trying to describe a picture, you will be able to just go to our social media and see the picture of Rachel trying to like overdose on acetaldehyde. But side story to the side story, that is, if you think that you might be anosmic to a certain compound like acetaldehyde, that is what Dr. Bill Simpson recommends in terms of figuring out, like, are you truly blind to it or do you just need more practice with it? And that's exactly what he says, is take a full-size spike, something that's meant to be in a liter spike, you know, just like a glass of beer, just a few ounces, and see if you can smell that. Mm-hmm. And if you can smell that, then obviously like you're not blind to it, but you just have to train on going lower and lower with those doses so you can still pick it up. And I've done that with ethyl acetate. It did not help. I still couldn't really get it. And I think to me, ethyl acetate is more of a feeling than a compound. And I'm not just saying that because
I totally get that. do you remember when we were in our class and, I was like, because part of the process of smelling is that really deep sniff. Mm-hmm. And I was doing that and I can feel the sensation in my nose. And Bill's like, why are you doing that? You can't, you can't taste that. Why are you making the face? I'm like, it's not what I taste. It's what I feel like up in my nose when I really, really get it, when it's deep. And he was like, right. Oh yeah. It's like, he's like, that makes sense. Like it's a sensation. So it is that particular one is pretty hard, but yeah.
So starting with acetaldehyde, it's one of those that I think I'm sensitive to it. So maybe that's why I'm interested in it, because I know that I'm good at it. But it's interesting, like not only how it forms, but it's one of those things that also, like, you've been affected by acetaldehyde, whether you realized it or not.
Oh yeah.
And I'll get to that. So I'll do some sciencey stuff first that I don't exactly understand, but I feel like it needs to be there. So acetaldehyde, as you can imagine, is an aldehyde. And there are different groups in, and I'm not even going to try to explain this like I'm a chemist, but you know, you have aldehydes, you have esters, you have phenols, you have vicinal diketones. So you have these different compounds in beer, and they're characterized by their molecular makeup. So an aldehyde is characterized by a carbonyl group flanked by a hydrogen atom on one side and a carbon on the other side. So if you, I say that like I understand what that means. But one thing that I think is kind of cool, I really love portmanteau. So words, you know, that are like anklet, you know, that is two words put together. So aldehyde is actually, since it's all sciencey, they say it's a contraction, not a portmanteau, but it's alcohol dehydrogenated. And that's going to be important later. And I know we've talked before about how, you know, like esters, their first name is the alcohol they're made from, and their last name is the acid that it's made from. So you have like ethyl acetate. So with compounds, if you see a compound that's ending in AL, that's an aldehyde. Whereas if it's ending in an OL, that's an alcohol. So that's something for me that is a good thing for me to keep in mind. The same way, like if it's a sugar, it will end in OSE. If it's an enzyme, it will end in ASE. So that's like, I've kind of taught myself a little bit or learned a little bit of chemistry over the years, but that is really helpful for me to remember that AL is an aldehyde, OL is an alcohol. Trans-2-nonanol ends in AL, trans-2-nonanol is an aldehyde. So there's a lot of different aldehydes besides acetaldehyde, but acetaldehyde is the penultimate step to ethanol. And one thing that I think is also interesting about acetaldehyde is that it is found in every single beer. Every single beer you have ever drank in your entire life has acetaldehyde in it. It's just whether it rises to the fault or rises to the level of being a fault. If it's, you know, if it's detectable in most styles of beer, then it's going to be considered a defect. But it is present in all beers the same way like acetic acid is present in all beers. It's just that it's going to be below the threshold of what we can taste. So of course, the thing that I tell people, you know, when you're looking at like the style guidelines and it says like low levels of DMS are not a fault. If you can taste or you can detect acetaldehyde, that's a fault. There is, you know, like Beer de Garde. I know Beck's beer has a spec for allowable levels of acetaldehyde. And we'll talk about that more in a little bit. So don't let me forget about why that may be so.
I actually was thinking the exact same thing as you, and I wrote a note about it. Because I have had people ask or say when they're trying to describe lagers, like an acceptable or a low level of this can be acceptable.
Two things. One thing that drives me absolutely crazy, and I know I've said it on this podcast before, and I know I've written about it in a couple of different places, the BJCP guidelines for American Light Lager and American Lager say that, and I think they've changed the wording now, but they used to say like low levels of, or like it has low levels of green apple. And what people interpreted that as is green apple is acetaldehyde. And what the, at least in terms of like Budweiser products, it is more of an unripe green apple rather than a Granny Smith apple. So in this case, in this context, the green apple is unripe apple. How do I know that? Mitch Steele told me himself. He was a brewer with Budweiser for like 20 some years. And that was something that I had actually said in a presentation, that acetaldehyde is acceptable in light lagers and lagers. And afterwards he was like, that's not true. And like, I know that this comes from the guidelines, but like, you know, it's Budweiser. We know how to brew beer without acetaldehyde. It's an unripe green apple. So one of the things that I've tried to hunt down, and I will also say, if you go back through the BJCP guidelines, initially they did say low levels of acetaldehyde. Then they changed it to low levels of green apple. And I think now it just says low levels of apple.
Now it says, like in the aroma part of American Light Lager, the last sentence, while a clean fermentation profile is desirable, a light amount of yeast character is not at fault. Yes. And that's what it says. And then flavor, it says clean fermentation profile.
Right. But if you go back through the other guidelines, you'll see that that language has changed. And that's fine. You know, language is a concept. It changes. One thing that I have been trying to hunt down, I had another friend send me an article to review about, just about off flavors. And in the acetaldehyde section, they had something about, you know, like low levels are allowable for like to lend to a crisp finish. And, you know, I put a note in there and said, what's your source for this? Mm-hmm. And they sent me the links for their source. And, you know, one of them is like the Brewers Association does one pagers on like different off flavors and how you can control for them. And so in that paper, it said like low levels are desirable for a crisp finish or something like that. I'm like, but where is this information? Why do we all keep repeating this? It's like the same thing of like, you know, mash like hopping was something the Germans did. I'm like, okay, what does Stan Hieronymus say about it? And he quotes this book and this book quotes Stan Hieronymus.
We're all just quoting each other.
Yeah. And, and I'm like, okay, but where? Like this information had to come from somewhere. Yeah. So I have been trying to dig down through all of these different papers to figure out, okay, but where, who is the first person who said that acetaldehyde is used in lagers to create a crisp profile?
Yeah.
I have not been able to find it, but I can see how this could be true, but not because of the flavor. So acetaldehyde will also interact with your saliva. Mm-hmm. And you have in your saliva, you have these compounds called glidins, and they're called glidins because they help your saliva and everything glide, right? Flow through your mouth. And acetaldehyde will precipitate those glidin proteins out of your saliva and give you kind of a gritty mouthfeel. And it can also, if you inhale really slowly through your mouth, like kind of wet your lips, inhale really slowly, you'll feel them drying out. That's also from acetaldehyde. So my theory or kind of my conclusion has been that something like that, you know, if acetaldehyde dries out your mouth, that will add to a crisp finish. Yes. We've also talked about how I don't like descriptors like crisp, because what does that mean? Then I'm like, okay, then that makes sense that you might have a little higher than normal level of acetaldehyde just to help dry your mouth out to give the perception of a crisp finish. Mm-hmm. So that's my theory. I will report back on if I can find something, because every paper I've looked at just says like, it's desirable in some lagers in light levels. And it's like, but who said that and why?
Yeah.
So that's my theory about acetaldehyde. And why that is there. And since I'm already talking about the flavor, I'll go ahead and finish up with the common descriptors for acetaldehyde: Granny Smith apple, latex paint, green Jolly Rancher. Fresh pumpkin is a common descriptor, but that's not actually correct. It's, I think it's like 6,3-hexanol is the fresh pumpkin flavor, and it's similar to acetaldehyde flavor, but it's not the same. And I get that in, like, I understand that as a concept. But for me, I also think I know people who pick up acetaldehyde as fresh pumpkin. That's the way that if they think they smell fresh pumpkin, then they know there's acetaldehyde. So in that case, it's like, well, no harm, no foul, you know, to me, because especially if you're working in a brewery and you're doing quality control, if you smell fresh pumpkin and, you know, you or you think you're smelling fresh pumpkin and that's yeah. your indicator that there's acetaldehyde, then that's good. You know,
yeah, like
you,
go with
so,
that.
Yeah. yeah. So for me, it's kind of like, yeah, I get that it's a kind of a, well, actually, it's not pumpkin. But if that's the connection that your mind has made, you know, that's still a pretty common descriptor. So I'm not going to come in and be like, it's actually not fresh pumpkin. You know, I'm just whatever. Like if you pick it up as fresh pumpkin, think that it's fresh pumpkin.
Yeah.
If that's what tells you that there's acetaldehyde in it. So one thing that I think is interesting, I know I keep saying one thing I think is interesting about acetaldehyde, but acetaldehyde is also one of there's just a few of flavor compounds that their character can change as the concentration changes. So, you know, like if you, it's kind of like diacetyl is diacetyl is diacetyl, right? Acetaldehyde is sometimes you can pick it up as latex paint. Sometimes you may pick it up as Granny Smith apple. And that just has to do with the concentration of acetaldehyde in whatever solution that you're smelling it in. Another reason why I think acetaldehyde is kind of tied into lagers is that the acetaldehyde can also be influenced by the level of sulfur dioxide concentration in the beer. So SO2. SO2 is very, very common in lagers. And so I think that, and I haven't kind of gone down that route to think about like, well, why would SO2 impact the flavor of acetaldehyde? But it does. So I think that's another reason why people may have come or how you can arrive at the conclusion that low levels of acetaldehyde are just in lagers. And it might just be because there's more of an SO2 concentration in lagers. And, you know, like that, the whole sulfur concentration in lagers is still kind of a mystery in terms of people don't exactly understand why that happens more so than with an ale. But that presence of SO2 is going to impact how you perceive the acetaldehyde. And I will say, I'm not sure if that means that you're more likely to perceive it or if it, you know, I don't know, somehow sets the stage where like the SO2 cancels out some flavor so you can smell acetaldehyde better. I don't know what those pathways are, but that is maybe another clue for why people would think that acetaldehyde or would associate acetaldehyde being acceptable in lagers.
I also think that, well, acetaldehyde is the last malabetic pathway to the ethanol production. So, you know, so it's the last step before that. So lagers with its really low fermentation temperature or long lagering time, I think it's very easy to maybe pull things off, quote unquote, early, where if you had given things another week, of course it will pick up a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Here, and that's just how long you want to allow something to lager too. So like,
that's true.
I think there could be both of those to
yeah,
play
I,
at
I
it.
Think that's a really good point. Okay, so let me tell you about how acetaldehyde comes into being. So when a yeast and sugar love each other very much. No.
With the help of oxygen.
Yeah. acetaldehyde is produced in the really early stages of fermentation, and it's reduced to ethanol in the later stages of fermentation. And we've talked about this in our fermentation in one of our episodes, I know, I think at least, in yeast has kind of three main fermentation stages. So there's the lag phase, which is where like the yeast is just getting to the party. It's kind of acclimating. It's getting to see like, okay, what's the deal? Who's here? Who's not? You know, what do I want from this party? So that's our lag phase. And then you have the exponential phase or the log phase. And that is the growth phase. So that's like yeast is there. They've got like their wits about them and they're ready to start partying. So that's the exponential phase. And then you have the third phase. What is the third phase called?
The death phase. There's a more scientific name for it, but
yes, there is. But yeah, it's basically it's the opposite of
dormant
the
phase.
Yes, something like that. Sorry, and I know there are people out there like screaming the answer. It's 10 a.m. on a holiday week. I'm on PTO. Everybody just relax. You know that there are three stages. You don't need me to tell you the last stage. You go look up the last stage. It will make you a better beer professional.
I'm looking it up.
Okay. You specifically, Rachel. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, so acetaldehyde is going to be produced in the earlier stages. And it's kind of like diacetyl, you know, in that aspect is where like it's created. And if you have healthy yeast, if you give the yeast enough time, you don't really have to worry about it.
Stationary phase.
Thank you. Stationary phase, everybody. Perfect. So we get it. So we've got our three phases. Now I know all three phases. Master Cicerone does not mean you're perfect all the time, although I mostly am. How does acetaldehyde show up in beer? So we know that yeast converts sugar to ethanol. So ethanol, of course, being our alcohol, ethanol ends in an OL. So we know it's an alcohol, but also we just know that ethanol is alcohol. So our first step is yeast is going to convert glucose to pyruvate and then pyruvate to ethanol. So this breakdown of, we're going to take one glucose molecule, we're going to break it down into two pyruvate molecules. That's going to happen inside the cell. And within the cell, the breakdown occurs in the fluid that's found in the cell. That's called the cytosol. And once that glucose has been broken down into pyruvate, that pyruvate has two choices, or like two different ways they can go. I wouldn't really call it a choice. But first, pyruvate can enter our powerhouse of the cell, the mitochondrion. And if it does that, if our pyruvate goes into the mitochondria, then it's going to get broken down into CO2 and water. That's what yeast would prefer to do. Or that pyruvate can stay in the cytosol, which is that fluid. And if it stays in the cytosol, it's going to get converted to acetaldehyde and then into ethanol. So why does yeast prefer one over the other? Well, because the first one, if there is aerobic respiration happening, so if there's oxygen present in that beer, then the yeast will prefer to have that pyruvate enter the mitochondria and be broken down into CO2 and water, because yeast is going to get more energy from converting that pyruvate into CO2 and water, which is what it does when oxygen is present. The second option, or the second kind of thing that can happen to yeast, is where that pyruvate stays in the cytosol, and then it's going to get converted into acetaldehyde and then ethanol. So that's going to be anaerobic respiration. So that's when if they don't have oxygen, they're like, fucking fine, I'll do this one instead. Yeah, so they
want to be aerobic, but we want them to be anaerobic.
Correct.
And they, Rachel, deal with it.
Yes. And you have said before, like, yeast doesn't give a fuck about your beer. Like, yeast doesn't care. Yeast is just trying to survive. And we're trying to basically like choke yeast to the point that they're almost dead. And then like, okay, now we have alcohol kind of thing. That's a little bit, that's kind of violent imagery, but I've been listening to a lot of true crime. So that's where we are with that. So,
and you'll accept it.
Right. So yeast does this because it needs NAD plus for two reasons. And I'll get to the NAD plus, but that's going to be nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide is NAD plus. So that's why I'm just saying NAD+.
Which is a type of energy that the yeast is going to use.
Yes. Thank you. The yeast need that for two different reasons. The first is for the reduction oxidation reactions. And again, I'm not a chemist, but basically oxidation is when you lose electrons, reduction is when you gain electrons. So the yeast needs that NAD plus to be able to oxidize and reduce electrons to complete their metabolism. Second, they need that NAD plus as an enzyme substrate. And the enzyme substrate is the molecule that an enzyme acts upon in a chemical reaction. So we just talked about if it ends in ASE, then it's going to be an enzyme. So lactase breaks down lactose, right? So lactose, OSE, that's a sugar. And that's also with like lactate and stuff is introducing lactate or lactase into your body so you can break down those lactose molecules. So that's just an example of what a substrate is. And they're very limited in what they can act upon. And one of the things that I remember about enzymes is like an enzyme is basically a hammer, right? So you can just hammer, you don't use it up, you know, like the maybe after a long time your hammer would get used up. But an enzyme is just a hammer. It's there to just, you know, hammer down the nails that it's supposed to hammer down. And we've talked about like enzymology in the MASH. You know, you have like alpha amylase and beta amylase. Those are also enzymes, and then the enzyme substrates that they're acting on is the alpha amylase sugars, the beta amylase sugars, etc. So that's why our yeast needs that NAD plus. They need it for their reduction oxidation reactions. They need it as an enzyme substrate. Yeast use that NAD plus to break down glucose, so like glucose as an enzyme substrate, right? So option two. That's why that's what's relevant for our conversation. So if there's oxygen, that pyruvate that has been broken down from our glucose molecule goes into the mitochondria and then into the Krebs cycle. And the Krebs cycle produces ATP. And ATP is important because it provides the cell, like Rachel said, with energy for protein synthesis and DNA replication, which is important for population growth. So that's our exponential phase of fermentation when our yeast is growing. And I'm not going to go into the Krebs cycle because I don't really get it, but I will with a side story. I have a friend who a few years ago was studying for the advanced Cicerone. And this was after I had already passed. So we were, you know, she was getting ready to take like the theory, the written part for the first time. And she came from a biology background. And she was like, you know, I have a good outline for the Krebs cycle and like the Crabtree effect and like all of this stuff that I was just like, yeah, you don't need to know that for advanced Cicerone. Like the Cicerone program is not trying to turn beer people into chemists or biologists. So, you know, I was like, the Krebs cycle is pretty deep down the chemistry rabbit hole. Like I would be shocked if you even got asked that like on the master, you know, like, so just know, just trust your pal, Jen. I got this from good resources that this is what happens. So if there's no oxygen, then the pyruvate, like we mentioned, remains in the cytosol and it doesn't go through the Krebs cycle. So what happens is you have a buildup of pyruvate, you don't have any ATP, and you've used up that NAD+. And so the yeast needs that NAD+ to be able to continue to break down glucose, you know, grow. And
the way I remember it is like the NAD plus is energy for the yeast to have certain enzyme reactions, and the ADP is a type of energy for reproduction and growth.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, and that makes sense. Oh yeah, that makes total sense. So we have there's a two-step reaction of pyruvate to ethanol that generates the NAD plus. I'm just going to say that happens by magic.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll just have to, yeast is magic, right? So as yeast creates this ethanol, it mixes outside of the cell. And they think part of why this ethanol will leave the cell and be like out in the wort is possibly as a defense mechanism. And there's a lot of really interesting stuff out like about, you know, like esters, they think were formed because yeast was trying to recreate the smell of like a ripe banana or something to, you know, to attract fruit flies. So then the fruit flies take the yeast and move it someplace else. And I remember that there was a CBC presentation where the guy was like, basically yeast has tricked humans into keeping it alive, but like humans thinking they're in control of yeast and fermentation, but it's like, no, yeast runs the world because we are just like, well, yes, of course we have to keep brewing beer. So ethanol is possibly a defense mechanism because your, you know, your yeast cell is also not as strong, right? Because you don't, you didn't go through that option one where you're creating energy to help you grow. So you've got this defense mechanism. And again, yeast doesn't want to produce ethanol, but it will to stay alive. So if you don't give it the oxygen, like I said, it'll be like, fine, I'll make fucking ethanol instead.
And it's very protective of its food source. So it makes ethanol in an effort to kill off mold and bacteria. Yes. So mold and bacteria won't eat its food source.
Right. And that's another part of the, like, this could also be a defense mechanism.
Yes, exactly.
Is so that way the yeast doesn't die. But as ethanol increases, it will become toxic to yeast as well. So that's also why, you know, if you've got a healthy, robust yeast strain, then you don't need to worry about this. Or that's also why if you're brewing like a beer with higher alcohol, you select a yeast strain that can tolerate higher alcohol, or, you know, you build like a big ass starter to make sure that you have enough yeast to deal with the alcohol that the beer is going to create. So that's how our acetaldehyde gets into our beer, is when yeast doesn't have enough oxygen. So it's taking its second option. It doesn't want to, but it will. And that's how we get acetaldehyde in the beer. And of course, if you don't have, again, if you give yeast enough time, if you've got a healthy yeast strain that you're using, if you've controlled your fermentation parameters correctly, that acetaldehyde will convert to ethanol and you will have like sub-threshold levels remaining in the beer. So sub-threshold meaning that you're not going to be able to taste it. If you have unhealthy yeast, if you take the yeast off the beer too soon, if you don't control your parameters, specifically temperature, then you're going to end up with excess acetaldehyde, which is going to be above our flavor threshold. So you're going to be able to taste it in the beer. The other thing, and this was something that was kind of new to me with the Crabtree effect. So the Crabtree effect can also create ethanol due to the high glucose concentration in wort. And what this means is that fermentation in beer will always result in alcohol, even if there is oxygen present. So even if you give yeast the oxygen it wants and it creates CO2 and ethanol, because of the Crabtree effect, because there's so much glucose in wort, like all brewer's wort is going to be above the threshold needed for the Crabtree effect to happen, you will still have alcohol always. And in a like beer fermentation, there will always be alcohol. You know, it's like you kind of think, well, then if oxygen doesn't matter, why are we trying so hard to keep oxygen out of beer? Like if we could just pump it full of oxygen, right, then we'll still have alcohol. The issue with that is that when alcohol is present, you have more metabolic pathways activated that can produce off flavors. So it's what we talked about, I think, especially like in our water episodes, a lot of brewing is like one step forward, two steps back, or, you know, you're making allowances for one thing because you don't want the other thing. So in this case, it's like, yeah, you could oxygenate the hell out of your beer, or you could just leave it open. You're still going to get ethanol, but because you've introduced oxygen, now you've got other things that are going to be activated in that fermentation that are going to leave you with off flavors. An example of that is high levels of oxygen can cause higher levels of acetaldehyde because ethanol oxidizes back into acetaldehyde. So like you're going to get acetaldehyde this way too. So that I'm explaining it to death, but that's the point, is you keep oxygen out, not because of the fermentation necessarily, but because of the byproducts that like an aerobic respiration will produce in fermentation.
And well, high levels of high levels of dissolved CO2 can also create acetaldehyde.
Right.
I know that is right. I remember asking during yeast class one time why that wasn't the case with the high pressure lager strain, which is constantly being fermented under pressure.
Right.
And he wasn't sure why scientifically. He was just like, the pressure is kind of like with the esters, the pressure's too much for them to excrete. It's kind of the gist I got behind it. But yeah, but without, I guess, that specific strain and appropriate parameters, high levels of dissolved CO2 can cause extra acetaldehyde.
Yeah, fermentation is so cool.
Yeah.
It just amazes me how much we still don't understand. And maybe what we understand about fermentation is completely wrong. It's just the theory that's made sense for the longest. So we've stuck around with it. But yeah, fermentation is just so cool. It's just amazing to me that in this world, I can mention offhand that I'm thinking about getting chickens or something, and suddenly all of your targeted ads on social media are going to be about chickens. And I bet, so you need to report back, Rachel, if that happens to you. And I'll do the same. Sorry, everybody who's listening now who's going to get targeted ads for raising chickens.
Well, I think it's important to talk about what happens in the brewing process that affects different levels of acetaldehyde and or fermentation. Obviously, fermentation temperature is a big component. The faster you go, or the higher your temperature, the faster your yeast fermentation is going to be, the more acetaldehyde it might end up with because of that. Because if it ferments too fast, it doesn't have enough nutrients and vitamins to finish its fermentation properly towards the end. If you have higher levels of alcohol or malt, gravity, you're going to need more oxygen to control that acetaldehyde. That's on a production side. Acetaldehyde can also happen on a packaging side, after the fact, if you're not fully fermenting everything and it can form over time in a package as a result of oxidation, which I know we hit on, but just kind of putting it into perspective of the process.
Yeah. And that is also why, because like Rachel just mentioned, ethanol, acetaldehyde is the penultimate state to ethanol. Ethanol, as it starts to oxidize, oxidizes into acetaldehyde. So like Rachel said, that can happen on the package side. That's very common in aged beers. So beers that are very old will also have acetaldehyde, and it's not because there was something wrong with the fermentation. It's because that ethanol has started to oxidize into acetaldehyde. But
yes, true.
What I like to make clear to people when we talk about that is kind of the same thing when you're talking about mercaptan or autolysis. If you're smelling acetaldehyde in a beer and you're like, oh, well, is this beer just old or does it have a fermentation issue? If the beer is old enough that that ethanol has oxidized into acetaldehyde, you're going to have a host of other oxidized characters in that beer that are going to tell you this is an older beer, right? Mm-hmm. So, less bitterness, less the malt shift in flavor, all of the things that come along with aged beer. And then there will also be acetaldehyde. If it's a fermentation issue, it might not only be acetaldehyde, but you're not going to have those aged flavors. So, if you've got a mystery beer in front of you, you can look at the context of the beer and determine was this acetaldehyde a fermentation issue or is this an old beer?
Yeah, it's a very good point.
Thank you. So I have a couple of other, they're not really fun, but they are facts about acetaldehyde and how, when I said we've all been affected by acetaldehyde, the human body metabolizes ethanol into acetaldehyde as its first step in processing alcohol. In our bodies, once we ingest alcohol, which alcohol is a toxin, our bodies are actively trying to get rid of it. And acetaldehyde, after ethanol has metabolized into acetaldehyde, is further metabolized by aldehyde dehydrogenases into acetate, and then from acetate into acetic acid. So it's as those things are happening, you're just flushing that out of your system. Enzymes, when your acetaldehyde dehydrogenases are deficient, it can cause the flush response that happens when some people drink alcoholic beverages. I know I get that. When I first drink a beer or any kind of alcohol, I'll kind of get red splotches on my chest and on my neck. And that's because I don't have enough of those enzymes at that moment, to be able to break that down fast enough. So how that happens is you have your capillaries in your skin are dilating, and that makes your skin redden. And that's also known sometimes as the Asian flush, because it's most prevalent in people of Asian descent. They don't have those acetaldehyde dehydrogenases. Those enzymes aren't present. And so that's why you can get flushed when you've got, when you're drinking alcohol. It's because it's an enzyme deficiency. So you can, well, actually somebody when they get flushed from drinking alcohol and tell them what's happening in their body. And this is, side story, it's a little relevant. When you grow up in a mostly rural place like the Ozarks, like I did, and like your nearest big city still has like 100,000 people, so it's not really that big, but it's got a mall and Olive Garden. you know people who work in like rural strip clubs, let's say. I knew somebody who worked as a bouncer at a rural strip club, and he had some alcohol issues. He had gotten arrested, I think, for DUI. So the judge gave him, or, you know, like ordered this medication that you take. This medication is called Antabuse, and it's a prescription medication, but it follows kind of that same concept of the acetaldehyde dehydrogenases, where it inactivates, this medicine inactivates that enzyme. So the idea behind that is when you take it, that is, that enzyme is inactivated. So your, that acetaldehyde in your system actually goes into your blood. So you start feeling those effects of acetaldehyde. So it's nausea, it's vomiting, and it also makes your skin red, right? So you get very red, like all over your body. And I knew about this drug because my friend who worked as a bouncer at a rural strip club had been like court ordered to take that. And
Jesus Christ.
had been drinking and got into a fight with somebody and had turned bright red because of this medication he was taking, and started like telling the guy, "I'm the devil."
Oh God.
So that's such a weird story to tell, but like, that's how I remember, like, this is what acetaldehyde does in the body. It's like, I remember that time Josh was really drunk and got in a fight and told somebody he was the devil because he was taking this court ordered medication. Anyway, that's growing up in the Ozarks for everybody.
That's hilarious.
But the, like, the issue with that medication is, of course, you can also just not take it.
Yeah.
And then you don't have those effects. Like, it's not something that you take for a while and kind of build up in your system. Like, if you want to go out and drink, you just don't take your medicine. So then you don't get sick, and then you don't tell people you're the devil because your skin's bright red. So given all of that, it's probably not a surprise. And I know we talked about this too in our hangover episode, but acetaldehyde will also contribute to your hangover symptoms. Because acetaldehyde is a toxin, right? And it binds to proteins and other compounds in your body that can, that will cause that nausea and vomiting. So the, your liver, like when you ingest ethanol, it goes straight to your liver, and your liver starts trying to process that. And your liver can process about one standard drink per hour. So that's, you know, like, I think it's what, like a shot of whiskey, a glass of wine, or like a pint of beer or something like that. And if you're drinking more than one standard drink per hour, your liver can't keep up with that. So that means that you have acetaldehyde accumulating in your body. So like when you wake up from a hangover, or you've got a hangover, you know, you've got like the terrible breath, you don't feel great, you've got a headache. Now that's also something when somebody's like, "I'm hungover," you can be like, "Do you want me to tell you why?" And you can tell them all about acetaldehyde. And that is actually some of what I read, and I know like in our hangover episode, we talked about like, you know, the best way to get rid of a hangover is just time and like fluids, you're dehydrated. But that idea of hair of the dog is because of the acetaldehyde. So if you wake up hungover and you keep drinking alcohol, then your body is still processing that. So, or, you know, it starts processing alcohol again. So you're just basically, you're staying drunk longer. Like you're not fighting a hangover when you stop drinking. That's eventually going to come back.
Yeah.
But that's why something like a Bloody Mary is so popular as like a morning drink or a brunch drink, is because of all, like, all of the different nutrients you can take in with that Bloody Mary, but also you're taking in that alcohol that's just kind of like keeping your liver busy for a little while. So the hair of the dog does kind of work, but it's just keeping you drunk longer. And whiskey, wine, sake, they all have higher levels. They all have high levels of acetaldehyde. Beer is actually like kind of on the lower level, relatively speaking, lower level of acetaldehyde.
Well, beer is controlled fermentation more than whiskey might be. They don't really care about the temperature. They just want it to go fast.
Yeah, that's true. That's a really good point. And also, I have had this happen to me with barrels. If you're barrel aging something, so like whiskey is, you can pull, not necessarily whiskey, since like American whiskey is first use barrels only. Mm-hmm. So there's not spirits in them, but that is something to be aware of. If you are barrel aging something, is what was in there before and how much is left over and how much sugar is in it, because you can put your beer into a barrel, and if there's sugars present that is pulling out of the barrel, then that, you know, then you can, and you've got enough yeast in there, it can kind of kickstart fermentation again, but it's, you know, it's in likely in a high alcohol environment already. So you're going to get a stressed out kind of mini fermentation, and that's going to create acetaldehyde. I have had that happen to me. I made a wheat wine that I wanted to age in a maple syrup barrel. I was so excited. I've been trying to like source a maple syrup barrel forever, and finally got one and did not take into account that something like maple sugar is maple syrup is incredibly sugary.
Yeah.
And put this beautiful wheat wine in this barrel, was so excited about it, pulled it out, and it was just an acetaldehyde bomb. And I knew somebody else who had also gotten a barrel like at the same time, and his had like terrible ethyl acetate. Like, that's one of the only times I've been able to smell ethyl acetate, because it was like straight polish remover. But, and he was just like, you know, the beer was wonderful when I put it in the barrel. What happened? I'm like, the same thing happened to me. And then thinking through it was like, oh yeah, it's because there's a lot of sugars in the barrel. And so that could also be why, you know, especially, I don't know, like things like wine, sake, whiskey might have higher levels of acetaldehyde, is because it's also pulling things from the barrel. But I agree with you with the whiskey, that I think that makes a lot of sense, is you're just trying to get it to ferment. You're not really worried about the flavor development.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah.
That is acetaldehyde.
That's a good episode.
Hey, thanks.
Good job.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of False Bottom Girls. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at False Bottom Girls. You can visit our website, falsebottomgirls.com. Or what else can you do? Oh, you can email us at falsebottomgirls@gmail.com.
False Bottom Girls is proudly sponsored by Jasper Yeast. Yeasts that are out of this world. Learn more about Jasper Yeast at jasperyeast.com.
This has been False Bottom Girls,
and we make the brewing world go round.